This is St. Louis Public Radio. Support comes from Para Corporation, a general contractor seeking professionals who want to make a difference in the community. More at parac.com/careers.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. After serving as a St. Louis Democratic committeeman and making an unsuccessful state legislative bid, State Representative Marty Jo Murray finally made it to the Missouri House in 2025. On the latest episode of Politically Speaking, Murray talks about his impressions of the General Assembly's lower chamber and the long road to deliver tornado relief to the city of St. Louis. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oratory over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's politics correspondent, Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me in studio today, he represents Missouri's 78th House District.
The best House District in the state, as I always say.
Who are you?
Marty Jo Murray.
It's been a long time coming to get on Politically Speaking, before we ask you about your life story and how you finally made it to the Missouri House, tell us a little bit about the geography of the 78th District.
Yeah, so the 78th District, I like to say it's the heart of the city. It stretches on the northern boundary a little bit into St. Louis Place, Old North. We have downtown, but we don't have the Arch. So we have all of downtown. It goes down past Cherokee Street, so we have the neighborhoods like Lafayette Square, Fox Park, McKinley Heights, downtown, a little bit of downtown west.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. When you got elected to this House seat, this was not the first thing that you were elected to or ran for. How did you get involved in St. Louis and Missouri politics?
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like, you know, people always call me a freshman, obviously, in the state house, but I've been in St. Louis politics going back to when Tasharra was my state representative. So I remember when I first graduated college from SIU in Carbondale, I went down to Jefferson City and said, let me go meet my state representative because I want to get involved in state politics. And she's like, well, I'm getting ready to run for treasurer, so come volunteer on my campaign. So that was kind of the start of my political career.
You were one of the people that ran for committee people seats in 2016, and you defeated Brian Wabi, who was like the most famous and powerful committee man of all. How did that happen?
How did it happen? Quietly, not poking the bear, because, you know, having no name recognition, no one really took me serious. But from my perspective, a year or so prior to that, I was like deep in the neighborhoods and the community meetings and, you know, meeting people at their doors before I even put my name on a ballot, you know. So I think from that perspective, we had faith. But I will say when he sent out the mailer with him, his family, and Barack Obama on it, I was a little intimidated.
So. Yeah. He was a pretty big wheel in the St. Louis Democratic Party. But you were on the St. Louis Democratic Committee for a while. And your first effort to get to the Missouri House was in 2019 after Bruce Franks resigned for mental health reasons. There was a very memorable intra-committee fight between you and Rasheen Aldridge. I was actually there. You came up short, but one of the things I noticed was, unlike some other committee races that get very ugly afterwards, I think you basically accepted defeat and went back into the private sector for a while. What prompted you to, like, not get super huffy about that outcome?
Well, one, as a committee man, I had an obligation to the party. So, you know, I think the trend now is if you lose the nomination, then you'll run it as an independent. And a big focus that Rasheen and I both had long conversations about was like not fracturing our legislative district. So, you know, the relationships that I had in the north side, that he had north side and south, we wanted to remain in unit because looking at that entire period, our block of all the people that voted for that nomination, we were so solid on all the other issues when it came to central committee things. And we didn't want to fracture the party anymore. And I also didn't want to set a precedent that, you know, just like you play the game and then you lose the game and then you pick up your ball and you know, you want to kick it over the fence. Like, I didn't want it to be one of those situations.
So then there was kind of this odd limbo period because former Representative Aldridge became Alderman Aldridge. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, a special election was not called in this district for like a year and a half or something like that?
It has to be. It has to be the longest time a seat has sat vacant.
Yeah.
It has to be.
And were you surprised Governor Parson didn't call a special election there?
Absolutely. I mean, I made calls. Like, we had legislators making calls, senators. I think the NAACP wrote a letter. I mean, because for people who believe in, you know, taxation without no taxation without representation. And it's like it didn't make sense because it was the only seat that was vacant. So it wasn't like it was a strategic thing.
I could understand keeping a Senate seat open for a while because those seats have more power.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes, especially if a Senate seat is vacant and the seat is competitive, you may not want, if you're a Republican, you may not want a Democrat to take it. I get that. Mm-hmm. But like, this was not a seat that was going to determine the balance of power the House. That's what made it a little bit confusing for me. And also, like, the governor is supposed to call special sessions without delay. Not calling it for almost a year and a half or 2 years seems like a pretty big delay.
Oh, absolutely. And that was part of the reason. I think one of the first bills that I filed was putting a time frame in terms of like compelling the governor to actually call that special election. And I think it will have bipartisan support. Some of the Republican legislators who will file similar legislation, you know, we have those two vacant seats now. And it's like, OK, if Governor Kehoe doesn't call a special, will you support this legislation to make sure we don't have seats that go unfilled, you know, while we're in this building working? So
you eventually ran for the 78th district seat. There was a competitive Democratic primary. Why do you think you ended up winning?
Just the time. You know, people talk about name recognition, but it was like deeper than that for me because you have a situation where you have someone who's relatively unknown. I think we had like another woman also running that was with, I think, a charter school or something like that. But then you have a candidate who you have known for years, you know, when it comes down to, I remember that time, like on the doors. Mm-hmm. I remember the time when you gave my nephew a book bag for his school, we didn't have school supplies for the past 2 years. So I think this, the relationship that I had throughout the district just kind of helped push me to be successful.
So now you're in the Missouri House. And before we talk about the special session, I'd just be interested, what are your initial impressions of serving in the General Assembly's lower chamber?
I think it's a tremendous honor. One of the biggest realizations that I've had thus far is how the opposite side of our chamber isn't compelled to compromise. And I think that's a dangerous thing because it doesn't have to be like the contentious issues. It doesn't have to be about guns, abortion, or you know, the hot button items, but just sent like healthcare, right? Like hospital, like making sure we have hospitals that open up. We look at the elements that were in House Bill 19, you know, like funding for cancer research and things of that nature. So it's a lot of things that we could be focusing on. But when you have no rationale to like have to compromise, I think that just sets a dangerous precedent. So for me, navigating that building has been very interesting, you know, learning the people, learning the players, but then also trying to find where I can fit in to bring back value for my district while I'm there.
Well, you're on the budget committee, and one of the things that I've noticed over the last 3, 4, 5 years is the Republicans who run the budget committee in the House often take a very hard line when it comes to putting forth a budget that spends less money. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening is the Democrats on the House don't like that. The senators from both parties don't like that. So the House Republicans always lose.
Yeah.
I've always found that to be an odd strategy because it's just self-defeating. If you involve the Democrats more in crafting the House version of the budget, then at least you'd have a better chance of salvaging it rather than just the Senate teaming up with the House Democrats and just ramrodding whatever the Senate wants through. I can't be the only person that noticed that, right?
No, I think that's fair. But one thing you have to consider as well is, like, they need their talking points when they go home. Like, that's what they ran on, right? Like, fiscally conservative, slashing the budget. So when they can go back home and say, well, we did what we were supposed to do. The Senate messed it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that creates that situation. But I also appreciate it because it's balance, right? Because they're going through trying to find, you know, what do they call it? We had our Missouri version of Doge. I forgot what they call it. Moge or something like that.
That seemed to fizzle out really quickly. Let's talk about the special session, which by the time this is posted or uploaded to your podcast dissemination devices, well, it had been about a week and a half or so since it ended. I was surprised, given how many things the governor wanted to do, that the special session was so successful. Were you surprised?
Absolutely. I was very surprised, but not so much because he got what he wanted, but because we passed anything. Because looking at the way that the session ended, with the Senate kind of blowing up and the PQs and then the House leaving early, I had no indication going into a special session that Missouri Democrats would have shown up to work, you know, because I think when it comes to breaking the decorum in that way, I think that something has to be done about that. So I didn't even think that the Senate was going to function during a special session. So the fact that they came to work, which I think part of it is obviously the tornado relief, but if that wasn't on the table, then we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it right now.
No, I think that I even asked Senator Steve Roberts that question. I think I talked with a couple of other senators. They just made the decision that the tornado relief was just too important to use their expected retribution on. But let's break down all the different aspects of the things that passed. I guess going from most controversial to least controversial. Okay. You were a no on the stadium funding, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Why were you not joining some of your fellow Democrats on the Kansas City side for supporting the incentive package to keep the Chiefs and the Royals from going to Kansas?
Yeah, so when that originally came through the House, which it was like sprung on us at the last minute, I was a present on it with respect to how my Kansas City folks felt about it. And obviously, I never wanted to be a part of the General Assembly that could be responsible for the Chiefs leaving, right?
And why does it matter? I'm sorry to interrupt, but why is it so critical that you prevent them from moving 10 miles away?
Well, I don't know that that's like the case that they would move 10 miles away, but I think it's also like the branding of the state, right? Like being able to have that chip on our shoulders to say, you know, to employers or to people that want to move to Missouri, that we have the Super Bowl winning however many time champions. Kansas City Chiefs.
I think they've won it four times, but continue.
You know, but that's the logic, right, is that we get to say that they are in Missouri and we can claim them. But, you know, as far as, like, why I voted no on it, like, that was one of those votes. It was a very tough vote also. But I don't know that I've received more phone calls and more emails, constituent outreaches for me not to vote for that than anything else, even more than Senate Bill 4 around the utilities. So, like, for me, it was a simple question. Like, I respect the voters, and, you know, and if I'm going to stand on it, I have to stand on it. And I also think that, you know, no knock to the Kansas legislators, but I think that General Assemblies across the country are setting bad precedents when we are doing it this way. Because if you are a corporation, right, if you look at something like downtown, like, right, we got the downtown revitalization, that's something where we need to step to the plate as a legislative body to say, let's help create something. The Chiefs are already established. They're like the best team in the NFL. Like, you know, the amount of money that they bring in, I don't know that the package that Kansas was offering them or that we even brought to the table was like justified in terms of need. I think at a certain point, the scales kind of tipped towards greed, and voters in my district were not in favor of that.
Well, I mean, I think there's another aspect specifically on the minds of St. Louis legislators, First of all, the Rams left after the state, the county, and the city dumped a whole lot of money into what was the Edward Jones Dome and is now the Dome at America Center. Mm-hmm. So I think that that created a sour taste for a lot of people when it comes to publicly financed stadiums. But the other thing that I don't think a lot of people mention is there was a precedent set by the soccer stadium. I'm not saying that the soccer stadium was had no public help at all because mm-hmm. they had to spend state money to clear the area because it was owned by MoDOT. There were some tax credits involved, and there's some direct sales taxes that are inside the stadium that go and pay off part of the stadium. But by mm-hmm. and large, it was largely privately funded. Yeah. And if that team is ultimately successful in the long run and makes hundreds of millions of dollars, you know what? More power to those owners because they put their own skin in the game. That's really not the case with the Chiefs or the Royals right now. It really seems like they are really leaning on the state and the local governments to fund their own enterprise. And I think that's for St. Louis legislators, that just seems like an anathema, basically.
No, literally. That's something I heard more often than not, like when I would be speaking to voters about how they think I should vote on that issue. You know, they would bring the case of the Rams. They would speak about the MLS team. And I think that's just like part of it, right? Like I just said something I simply couldn't support.
But the other part of that bill that I think is also controversial is there's like a whole bunch of patchwork property tax relief that was basically put in there to, I guess, get support of some more conservative senators. Now, I don't believe it affects the city of St. Louis or St. Louis County or Jackson County. I think there's a feeling that like that is not going to stand up in court and that even discussing its impact is kind of pointless. But like what happens if it does stand up in court? What's going to be the effect on some of those, taxing jurisdictions if that ends up passing constitutional muster?
Yeah. So for me, that was absolutely a big part of why I also voted no. Like if the stadium provisions in itself was 1A, like those provisions around real property taxes was 1B, which is ironic because you have Republicans who weren't voting for it because their counties weren't included, and Democrats weren't voting for it because we just think it's bad in terms of like the model for how we fund education. And for me, even though St. Louis was excluded and even though we have the severability clause and everything like that, I still think that it's bad to give breath to legislation that will eventually hit our city. So like, even though we're not included today, when we come back in the spring, who's to say that St. Louis won't be on that chopping block as well? Because you talk about what are the things that are the focus for next session, because they got so many things done. The one thing that I heard them say over time and time again is they want to get rid of taxes. So whatever that looks like, property taxes, state income taxes, like they want to cut taxes. So I could easily see that being a bill filed next session that I will have to fight against.
You know, I kind of see both sides of this. I think that people that don't want to hamstring counties from issuing property taxes don't want like school funding to dry up or for essential county services to dry up, or in the case of the city of St. Louis, which is a city not within a county, you know, their basic city services. On the other hand, I do understand people who are really upset when like their property taxes go way up. Like we got our property tax bill in St. Louis County, or at least our assessment, and we were pretty surprised like it went up like 15-16%. How do you like thread the needle to where you're not taxing people out of their homes, but you also have a genuinely stable funding source for government?
Yeah, I think it starts with conversations with the various assessor offices in terms of how they assess market value for properties. But then also, I think it will calm a lot of anxiety around it if legislators have a hard conversation about how do we fund education in a way that's complete, you know, where we're paying teachers what they're worth and students are getting the quality education that they need to where Missouri isn't ranking in the bottom. So if you address that part of it, I think it makes the other parts of the conversation a little bit easier.
We'll be right back after this quick break with State Representative Marty Jo Murray. And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Representative Marty Jo Murray. He is a Democrat who represents Missouri's 78th House district. Now let's go to the part of the special session that seemed to have almost like unanimous support. Not completely, because I think there were a couple of your colleagues who voted no. And that's the tornado-related relief. And I want to go through all the different aspects. The one thing that I think has gotten less attention that I think could be very helpful for people is this tax credit to help people recoup their insurance deductibles. Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of focus on how a lot of people didn't have insurance and that they have to lean on FEMA or the city or the $100 million we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. But initially, the governor proposed a tax deduction and not a tax credit. And I did a little bit of simple math. And if you had $100,000 in taxable income and you got the tax deduction, you would have gotten $230 from that tax deduction, which I think was woefully inadequate. Mm-hmm. But the other side of this is tax credits are just more expensive to the state. So how did it morph from a deduction to a tax credit without arousing a lot of opposition from Republicans who don't want to spend a lot of money on something like this?
Yeah, I think that, and from what I've noticed, like, we got out of session. The next day we came home, and that's when the devastation struck. And I would say we had Republicans, Democrats, representatives, senators from all over the state that came to St. Louis and saw the devastation firsthand. So I think when you see the scale of it, I think that kind of forces people to get serious about what are we going to do to try to help people.
So let's talk about the $100 million that will go directly to the city of St. Louis. Not directly, because the Department of Public Safety will be administering it, but it's going to help the city in particular. Mm-hmm. This is another proposal that was not initially set forth by Governor Kehoe. I think initially he wanted to give $25 million to the Missouri Housing Development Commission to help with temporary housing. How did it get to a point where you got $100 million in addition to the $25 million for MHDC?
Because that $25 million was almost felt like a slap in the face to voters, because not only is it not $25 million that would have went directly to St. Louis, it was like, I think, 37 counties who would have benefited from it. Mm-hmm. When you look at the scale of the damage being $1.6 billion, like estimates being $1.6 billion in damages, what is $25 million? You know, so like the fact that the Senate, I would say, you know, kudos to the senators who were able to negotiate a better deal for St. Louis, pushing up to 100. I think that helps, but still, $1.6 billion, and when you have a federal administration who is pushing states to take ownership of their own disasters, we have to seriously sit down and look at it to say, what can we do as a state to make St. Louis whole, and how early we are in a tornado season, you know, knock on all the wood, like, unfortunately, other places that might be also impacted by natural disasters. So I think it's something that we have to seriously sit down and think about how we approach natural disasters.
How do you want this $100 million to be spent?
Jeez, it's so hard to even, because it's so short of the need.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine, like, how to approach it. I mean, obviously, when we look at, like, infrastructure, like, making sure utilities and, like, people are just made whole in terms of, like, just the electrical grid being repaired, like the people's homes who have, like, because I think the city went through and they did the like the red, amber, and green stickers on the homes.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, I would want to address the homes that are red or potentially could be condemned to where people can actually move back into their home.
I understand why a lot of people are upset that the city is condemning homes, but I kind of want to play devil's advocate and put myself in the city's position. If you're in a situation where you're a building inspector and you look at a home and you know that it is not habitable, or you may suspect there's like asbestos or some other deadly chemical in there, if you didn't put that red sticker there and somebody stayed in that house and then died of asbestos poisoning, you would be responsible for not saying this home isn't safe. But on the other hand, like, there's a lot of distrust with city government. Mm-hmm. And some people may see that as, you're trying to steal my home and you're trying to take my home that I've like had for many, many decades. Mm-hmm. Again, we've talked about kind of the balance between these two extremes, but like, what is the middle ground to where you're keeping people safe, but you're also giving them the opportunity to keep their property that they own and that's theirs?
Yeah, so I agree with you in the sense that the city had to do that, right? Because not even just asbestos, when you look at some of the homes, just not being structurally sound. Like, and I know a lot of the emotion is there for people in terms of wanting to stay there, you know, and, you know, your livelihood is in that building, even if the walls aren't all intact. But how do you balance that in terms of, as a city, to show good faith that we aren't about to, like, hyper-gentrify this area, is that you go in and you help fix those homes.
Right. And I think that's going to be the big challenge. We talked about insurance earlier. I think it's a misnomer to say that some of those homes didn't have insurance. Some of them didn't. Some of them did. But the value of the house, especially the ones in North St. Louis, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 worth of insurance, and it's going to cost $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 to rebuild because they're all made of bricks, and bricks are expensive.
Oh, yeah.
So you're right. The $100 million is not going to be enough. The FEMA money is not going to be enough because FEMA only gives about $43,000 for home repair.
Yeah.
How are you going to reach a point where you get to $1.6 billion without the state committing a lot more money? Are the city just devoting the entire RAM settlement to this?
No, I think that's my job, right? Is that when we go back in the spring, that's going to be on the top of mind of every conversation that I have, because I think people are still going to be impacted by this for years to come.
And I also think it's worth mentioning that even if you have insurance and even if you get an insurance payout relatively quickly, the other issue is that contractors that actually do this work are insanely busy right now. Mm-hmm. And then I've heard some people, there are not enough bricklayers in the country to rebuild all the houses in North St. Louis. So I think it gets to the other question of what do you do even if you have the money to repair, but it just takes 6 months or more to repair this. Like, what? That's where I guess the temporary housing aspect of this comes into place. Can you speak to that point?
Yeah, no. So I think you're exactly right, because like with FEMA, you know, people can go in and apply for it now, but it looks like that, like the home repairs, it looks like temporary housing assistance. It's so many different elements of what you can request. And my understanding is, I think it was like $71 million coming down for FEMA was just preliminary.
Yeah, I think it's going to be much more than that.
Yeah.
I don't know where that $71 million is coming from, but if you're just talking about for individual assistance, I don't really think there is a cap. It's just depending on who applies and who ends up getting approved for it. But continue. Yeah.
No, I mean, that's the point that I'm making, is that we as a government, we as elected officials, like, we have to do our best to get the information out to people. Because, I mean, I heard cases where, you know, people were being, you know, confined to their homes, maybe not having a computer to go in or app that where they can download it. So I think there's going to have to be a major effort to be able to help people get the information to get whole again. And the one thing that I do want to, because I don't think we had the opportunity to shout them out, but like the amazing community response that we've seen from the People's Response, I think For the Ville, the Urban League, so many organizations.
Action St. Louis, which I think is part of the People's
Response. I say the People's Response because that's who, you know, For the Culture and Action St. Louis.
Yeah.
Like, kind of organically.
I talked with two people who were involved with the For the Ville emergency hub. And I asked them a question that this volunteer response really was incredible. And I think that it should be lauded and copied for years to come. Oh, yeah. On the other hand, I could understand that those volunteers may have been a little miffed that the onus for the short-term response was on volunteers and not city, state, or federal government. I'm not saying city and state government didn't do a lot, but the initial response, the onus was really on these volunteer organizations until the city has recently kind of taken over. Mm-hmm. Is it, how do you change that in the future, or can you change that in the future?
You know what? I don't even know that I would want to change it, right? Like, obviously, I don't want, because people are like calling off of work and it's very challenging and demanding in terms of the response. But my faith in humanity was restored just a little bit, seeing how neighbors helping neighbors. Like, if obviously I would like governments to be able to come in and support. But like the way that I seen, like, you know, like neighbors coming together, like how organic it grew. Because it was literally, hey, y'all, where do we want to meet up? Let's go up to the Y because it's close to the highway.
And also, they may just have more trust with people. We talk about, we have it, there is an inherent distrust of city and state and federal government. if it's a volunteer-led organization, these are people that are already well-known in their various communities. So I can see both sides. But I do want to talk about this odd political situation we have in the city of St. Louis. So this tornado occurred right after a mayor's race that I think was pretty contentious. I think it's fair to say it was decisive because Kara Spencer won easily. But what I have kind of noticed is in the aftermath of this tornado, it does seem like we're in a period of like political detente with all the various factions and personalities. You have like Megan Green and Kara Spencer working very well together. They're not politically aligned. I understand that many of the North Side alderwomen supported Kara Spencer over Tashara Jones, but even some of the people that didn't are working pretty well with Mayor Spencer. I think this is good because this is a crisis situation, and I think that it would be not beneficial to the recovery if there was just petty sniping going on. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, though, I think if you're making like really big decisions about the future, I don't think they should be unanimous. There should be some give and take and polite disagreement on the longer term stuff. So what do you kind of make of this odd but maybe heartening political moment you have in the city of St. Louis?
Yeah, I think that is justified. Like, this is what we need. We don't have time. Like, when you look at people being pulled from their homes to be saved and livelihoods being destroyed to a part of the city that has been disrespected and neglected for generations, we don't have time for, like, petty politics. But, like, I think, you know, the honeymoon as far as, like, the kumbaya that we've seen, how long will that last? I think it's just as soon as the next issue comes up.
And I do think there are some, like, legitimate shortcomings that came from this tornado that need to be dealt with. The siren situation is one of the things that comes to mind. But I would just say the overall emergency response infrastructure of the city just needs to be expanded. If you have a situation where there are only, like, what, four or five employees that were there before this tornado happened, and you know, St. Louis County has far more and has far more advanced infrastructure. I'm not saying it's Mayor Spencer's fault per se because she was in office for 30 days, but I do think that needs to be expanded permanently so there can be a more robust city response the next time this happens. What's kind of your thought on that?
No, I agree. It's something that we have to consider. One thing that I you know, we'll get to it when we talk about what's coming next. But me being appointed to the Futures Caucus in the State House, those are the type of things we have to look at as far as, like, what are the issues that are, like, coming in the future that we don't have the infrastructure or the legislation to address. And when I look at the fact of the impact for climate change on these natural disasters, when I look at the fact that the tornado alley has shifted to where we are now, as you talk about that robust overhaul of, like, how do we look at emergency response, like, that has to be a part of the conversation.
I mean, I know that combining city and county things is really controversial, but I think that if there was a joint city and county emergency response where the city and county were pooling money together and they were all under one agency, and if there's, like, a bad disaster in the city, people who work in the county can respond and vice versa. That may be something to look at, and I'm not sure if you need state legislation for that, but, like, if there has been anything that has, like, struck me in the face after this tornado, it's that having the city and the county separate has been not advantageous in certain areas.
So you really wanted this to be a lively debate this morning, because I'll let you know how I feel about city county mergers.
Do it.
But when it comes to, like, the things that make sense, right? Like, my whole issue when you talk city-county merger is more so with when you start to eradicate the city's governance structure. If you keep it to, like those type elements, right? And I think Mayor Jones and Sam Page, like, the conversations and the way that they would collaborate, like, I think that, like you say, you don't need state legislation.
Yeah, like when they were talking about, like, how the county can help with the unhoused situation. I have said for years that the county's non-involvement in that has been one of the biggest issues to doing anything on that. Yeah. So you mentioned next year. What do you all do next year now that Republicans have passed everything?
right, exactly. Right, we just kick our feet up. No, but I think that the fight will still be there for Democrats, right? Because the cutting of taxes, funding education. I think that one thing that didn't pass was around what is it called? Like the gun legislation?
Yeah, the Second Amendment Preservation Act or something.
I think that still rears its head next session. But for me, I'm just apprehensive in terms of what is the Senate going to do, because I've seen firsthand that whatever the Senate decides that they want, like, that'll kind of dictate the pace, because it was a point in this past previous session where they weren't hearing any House bills. So we could pass 500 bills. But if they aren't even going to see the light of day on the sitting side of the building, then it's kind of mute.
You're on the budget committee, and one of the things I've been, like, hounding members of that committee about is pay for children's division workers. Mm-hmm. The governor has heard, like, 30 different questions from me about this topic ever since I started diving into this issue. It did not seem like that had any momentum this year of, like, significantly raising the starting salaries for Children's Division, especially child abuse investigators. The starting salary, by the way, is around $45,000, $46,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But the governor does say that, like, he wants to seriously look at pay for that agency. Is that something that's on the radar of the budget committee?
I think so. I mean, I think when it came up last session, like, I seen bipartisan interest in it. So
yeah, I think it's,
I would be encouraged.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of, like, how you structure it, and, like, you can't just have, like, one part of the children's division getting raises and not all of it. Because mm-hmm. like, if you're managing, like, foster care and you're making $40,000 and then suddenly the salaries go up in another area to $60,000, well, you're gonna want $60,000, obviously. So you gotta do it kind of in a methodical, smart way. But the way it's structured now, I think both Republicans and Democrats have told me, it's just not working, because yeah. it's not incentivizing people to work at that very, very difficult agency.
No, I agree 100%. And I don't know that it's something that's, like, common knowledge, but me, myself, and my siblings were former foster children. So the work that they do in that agency is just tremendous. And I think that anyone you ask in that building would be for, like, providing pay raises for the people that are doing that work to our most vulnerable children, right? Like, that's our responsibility as a state to make sure that we're doing right by them. And the workers that, you know, work day in and day out should be compensated as such. But like you say, it's not just that you do it, it's how you do it.
There is a feeling that the budget's going to get a lot tougher in the next few years.
Oh, yeah.
There's not as much federal money. The growth of the state's revenues are kind of flat. There is still a little bit of surplus left, but it's dwindling compared to where it was. How do you think legislators are going to get through this process without making, like, really stark cuts to state agencies?
I don't know that we can avoid that part. I mean, if anything, we'll just have to look hard in terms of, like, how do we drive additional revenue to our state? Like, we have to start thinking about that very seriously soon, because, I mean, we've seen it, and we see it. That was the big, beautiful bill that they're trying to pass in D.C.
I got to admit, I know people make people are going to be like, what
you like
are you talking
you like
about?
The branding of it?
I kind of like
you
the name.
You don't like the name.
You can. Just,
I hate what's in it, right?
But. You could hate. I think it's kind of a clever name. I'm not going to lie, but continue.
No, but that's my point, right? Like, you look at that temperament being set at the federal level of, like, cuts and less money coming in through the state. I mean, we had a really golden age of, like, being able to fund, like, the social programs that we have come to appreciate and the constituents have come to depend on. But I think that we're going to have to start taking a hard look at those programs, because they're going to be on the chopping block.
Okay, this is a wacky proposal, but, like, hear me out
what
for
you
a
got
second.
For me?
So there are all of these things that have passed through ballot initiatives, sports betting, marijuana, mm-hmm. medical marijuana, and all the funding streams have been tailored to get those things to pass. So, like, veterans, education, I'm not saying, like, you completely take those things away from those things because they're important, but maybe put something on the ballot that, like, increases those taxes and just have them go to general revenue. And basically tell these very powerful industries, the legislature's taking control, baby, and not you, big marijuana and big sports betting. What do you think about that?
I think you're going to need somebody to walk you to your car when you leave this building.
Oh, my gosh.
No, but I'm not mad at that idea. You know, I'm not mad at it, because, like I said, we have to look at serious ways to drive more revenue in a space where we're going to see so many cuts. So
I'm guessing
that's a lever.
I'm guessing that chances of the Rosenbaum tax plan passing are less than zero. Thank you so much for coming today. For all of our stories, go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. How can people find you on the World Wide Web, mainly social media where you want to be found?
Sure. So they can always go to the House website to find out updates about what's going on in Jeff City, house.mo.gov. And then my personal website is martyjoemurray.com. And I do a Capitol Corner where I kind of give my thoughts on legislation and things that I have going on in the community. So they can always find me at martyjoemurray.com.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.